Maggie, I've been sitting there thinking, oh, I can't wait to hear the speaker. Now here I am. So, my name is Maggie, and I am a very, very grateful Al-Anon, recovering Al-Anon. I've been a part of Club 12 and the Al-Anon program in this dear little room here for about 15 years. And I feel very, very honored to speak to you all on their 68th anniversary. Mine, 68. I'm not 68 yet. Anyway, I wanted to say, too, that Al-Anoners go the extra mile, don't they just? We have speakers from Arizona and California invited here for AA, and good old Al-Anon brought in a New Zealander, for goodness sake. I'm jet-lagged, y'all. But seriously, I've been here 25 years. I've just had a hard time losing the accent. So, a little bit about my story. I grew up, obviously, in New Zealand, into a family that had alcoholism in every generation. It was not my parents who were the alcoholics, but it was brothers, sisters, mothers of theirs that were. And my first experience of the shame attached to that back in the 50s was when my uncle Dougie died. He was about 42 at the time, and I was around 5 or 6, maybe 7. And he'd come back from World War II a hero, as had my father. My father came back with his beautiful bride and a beautiful 18-year-old woman that he'd met in Guyana, where he'd been in the Navy, with the British Navy. And my mom had grown up in Guyana, one of 7 children, the daughter of a missionary there. Her mother was an alcoholic and died in her early 40s. And so they came to New Zealand, and we were a family of 4 children, and my dear Uncle Dougie lived with my grandmother, who was a very controlling and enabling person. And unfortunately, his alcoholism got the best of him, and she couldn't cope, and she asked my father to deal with it. And so he put him on a ship and sent him to Australia to an asylum, where he died from cirrhosis, all alone. I don't even know where he's buried. All I knew was that there was a tremendous amount of shame attached to his passing. And he was not talked about, and his memory was brushed under the carpet. And anything I ever learned about him was from an older cousin years later. So about 12, my father, the hero child, stepped up and took over the family business and was very controlling and very controlling of all of us. And we followed his lead. And when I was about 12, my older sister started to show signs of severe mental illness and ultimately had to be hospitalized for a year in something that was similar to an asylum. And so the history was repeating. My father didn't want to deal with it. It was too painful. He paid the bills and just kept going to work. My mom, who was the most amazing, strong woman, kept everything together, loved and laughed and sang and made us happy no matter what. So when I was about 12, she wanted to go down and visit her daughter in the asylum, and my father refused to go. So I went, the little helper, mom's little helper, age 12, not knowing what was wrong with my sister, and went down there and visited with her. I was totally puzzled and didn't really understand what was going on with her, other than I knew my mom was very sad. Okay. Time went by, my sister got well. They found the right medications for her. She came back and lived at home again and went to school again. And when I was about 16 years old, my brother, age 21, committed suicide. We had shame upon shame upon shame. And it just about killed my father, who, the workaholic, just buried himself in work and blamed himself terribly for the mistakes that he must have made in his mind. We kind of blamed him, too, for being so hard and so rigid. And it wasn't until years later, when I was working my program and did a fourth step, that I felt his pain and understood how hard it had been for him and my grandmother. So with that happening and my brother's photos gone, my uncle's photos gone, we carried on as best we could under the circumstances. And when I turned 18 and finished a year in college, I decided, I'm out of here, dude. This is too serious and too sad. So I got on a plane, went to Australia with friends. I lived there and had a great time, really a kind of wild time, actually. And I continued to travel for the next few years and lived my life in a kind of not a very productive way. Just wanted to forget everything and try to have fun. I was fortunate that I had friends that were always very, not very, kind of responsible. And I didn't go down certain paths that I could have gone down. I was a bit of a scaredy cat when it came to drugs. You know, I liked alcohol, but the other stuff was, I don't like to lose control. That's what qualifies me for this program, by the way. You guys, some of you like to lose control. And when you lose control, I like to control you. Go figure, we're a match made in heaven. So you can see I was programmed from an early age to be a caretaker, rescuer, controller, fixer, codependent kind of a person. And the motto that I had after my brother died was, nobody's dying on my watch, dang it. I am going to be that friend that makes sure that anyone that's struggling is not going to struggle. I'm going to be right there with them. And I did. I mean, I had a best friend who had a terrible depression and she didn't want to tell her family. I was the one that went and sat at the psychiatrist's office with her. I was the one that went to her mother's house and helped her tell her what was going on. So I became a sort of little mini counselor slash controlling. And I got a lot of pleasure out of it, by the way. When people, oh, you're such a wonderful person. What a great friend you are. I'd be like, yep, that's me. Whoa, that's me. So time went by and I ended up in a country for 4 years in the Middle East where I had a pretty responsible job. And I met the love of my life. I was 25 and he was 30. And he had just returned from the United States where he'd gone to school. And he was very American. I thought he was an American, actually, when I first met him. Discovered that he was actually from the country we were living in, which was Iran. And we had a great romance and got married there. Beautiful wedding in the 70s during the Shah's time when things were a lot more stable. We continued to live there. And planned to stay there really for probably the rest of our lives until the revolution came along and it became dangerous, and particularly me, looking not very local, we decided probably a good idea to go and live in New Zealand for a little while and this will all blow over. So pregnant with our first child off, I went to New Zealand and my husband stayed there. He had a good job and he was trying to keep that going. And I felt very lonely back in New Zealand with this little baby growing inside of me. But we got through it, and our beautiful daughter was born. And after about 6 months, we decided that since Iran was still not looking very hospitable, to go and live in America. So we came to the United States where my husband's sister was already in Houston. And we set up home there, and we kind of spent time there hoping that things in Iran would come right, which they didn't. They didn't. The hostage crisis and so on went on. And so we decided we need to make a decision. Are we going to stay in America, which was difficult? We didn't have the right visas to be able to stay to work and so on in those days. So we decided to go back to New Zealand. And that was a huge and difficult step for my husband. I was thrilled. I mean, I was going back to friends and family and familiar things. So we went back, and our second child was born, and we had a very idyllic time for probably about 6 or 7 years where they went to school and they hung out with their cousins, and it was a very wonderful New Zealand lifestyle, family lifestyle. But unfortunately, my husband didn't feel settled there. It's very remote, it's an isolated country, it's far away from everything, so different from what he was used to, that he decided it was time for him to come back to the States and see what he could find here. And sure enough, he had an opportunity to get into a business with an old friend and get a green card accordingly and so on. and we ultimately came to San Antonio, Texas in 1992. We came here. The children were 10 and around 13, and they were excited. Wow, you know, the land of sneakers and all kind of things. And they went to school, and they quickly got involved in sports and all kinds of things, and life seemed to be going pretty well. During that time, my dear brother-in-law died age 42 from a sudden heart attack, and this raised all my old grief issues that I'd never dealt with, never had any counseling for. Remember, we brushed it all under the carpet. Let's not talk about it. Let's pretend my precious brother had never been here. So I decided I needed to go and get some counseling, which I did. And I stayed in counseling for about 4 years, and during that time, she said to me, "Have you ever thought of joining Al-Anon?" What? What's that? What is that for? You know, so there was a seed planted at that point. I never actually did anything then, but I heard what she said. Now I felt strong enough to actually do some service work, so I volunteered at the Children's Bereavement Center here in San Antonio, and became a trained facilitator. And while I was there, I can remember God spoke to me. This was where my calling came from. I was working with the adults. We would break off into groups, and 10-year-olds would be in one group, and the teenagers in another, and the little children in another. And I was helping the adults process how they were managing, the caretakers of the children. And there was this young man there, aged about 35, who was so brave and so courageous with two dear little children. And his wife had died in her alcoholism. She was diabetic, and she just couldn't stop drinking, and she died. And here he was, trying to keep the pieces together with these precious children. My heart just went out to him. And I thought, I don't want to be helping after the person has died. I want to help her live. I don't want her to miss out on her children and her life at 30 years old because of alcoholism. And so I said, "God, help me find what I need to do this." It became a total calling. And I started to look around and make inquiries. And before you knew it, I was at San Antonio College studying to become a drug and alcohol counselor. Now remember, I'm still very controlling, a rescuer, a caretaker, and a fixer of others. And I will get in your business in a heartbeat. My hula hoop stretched for half the continent of the United States. So how am I going to be a good counselor with zero boundaries? I wonder. But it was here. It was on my heart to do this. So this is what I did. And about the same time, our son was starting, and I have asked him if he minds me sharing a little bit of how our stories intersect. I don't want to tell his story. His story is an amazing story, and it's his. But about this time, he was starting to run into trouble in junior and high school with a minor in possession here and there, and problems. You know, I get a call from the principal's office, "You need to come down and pick up that boy of yours, rah, rah, rah." And I was clueless. I had no idea what was going on. You know, we'd round him for a few days, and yeah, I'm not going to do that again. And sure enough, something else would happen. So we was running into legal problems, medical problems here and there. And I began to feel very helpless and terribly afraid that I couldn't stop what was happening, that this was beyond my caretaking, rescuing, controlling, fixing, codependent degree. That it needed someone else probably to step in here. So we, after a particular crisis, decided that treatment was in order, and he agreed thankfully, and off we went to the Hill Country, and we attended a family group there. Chris Raymer was the speaker. And that was the first time I truly understood alcoholism was a disease. And I remember crying after that talk that he'd given, and my son and husband looked at me and said, "What is wrong with you?" And I said, did you not hear what he said? This is going to go on for the rest of his life. This is a chronic illness. This is not him being a naughty teenager like we've been thinking. This is a real illness that he's going to battle for the rest of his life. And it hit me right there. And I felt for him. I felt for him. I felt for all of us. I had a feeling that this was going to be a very rocky road, a boat that was going to be going all over the place. And by the way, I get seasick. And remember, I don't like pills. So at that, I went to an Al-Anon meeting in Ingram where these darling people, they were darlings, talked to us, and they knew that we were all deer in the headlights, that we were there coming from a treatment center, and we were clueless. And they were so sweet and so welcoming. I have never felt more understanding and more comfort. Remember, I came from a place of shame. You don't talk about alcohol and mental illness and people that are not doing well in life or behaving themselves. You don't talk about it. And here I was with a group of people who were talking about it, but in a way that they were okay with it, that they could actually laugh at themselves and their own crazy behaviors. And so I thought, you know what? Maybe there is something to this jolly old program. So we came back to town and life continued, and I started coming to Club 12. And I would sit in this room here and listen away. Pretty soon they're going to tell me how to fix this child of mine, right? Six meetings, they said. So six meetings I attended. And on that sixth meeting, I thought, ha! Why have they not given me the instructions yet? I am tired of hearing about how happy they are and what they're doing. Tell me how to fix this kid of mine. So after the meeting, I boldly went up to Henry. He probably wouldn't even remember, but Henry was. He's probably here somewhere. And I said to him, you seem to know a lot. You seem to know. You're wise. How can I fix this son of mine? He said, with these wise and kind eyes, you need to give him to God. And I looked at him and said, are you crazy? God gave him to me. He doesn't understand. This is not a husband or a wife. This is my child. You don't divorce children. So I kept coming back, thankfully, because that's what they kept saying. Keep coming back. I would say something, some ridiculous statement in there, and they'd say, keep coming back. And all right. Oh my gosh. I always felt very comforted by knowing Club 12 was here. I would drive up and down San Pedro and think, there's Club 12. Thank God it's there. It would be in the back of my mind. You know, God is always in the front of my mind, but for a tangible, I can come somewhere and feel okay place, it was Club 12. I remember one time heading home from Houston. There'd been some debacle. There are always debacles, right? Over there, and I was feeling desperate, and I thought, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? Again, not thinking about what Henry had said. And I drove straight to and by the way, I didn't have a sponsor by then either. Bit of a problem. So I drove straight to Club 12, came through the door like a mad woman. It was not a meeting time or anything. It was just a few people wandering around. And sure enough, there was some poor young man sitting here minding his business. And I head over to him like the crazy woman that I am. Oh my God! What am I going to do? I have a son about your age, and this is what's going on. And he looked at me. He said, ma'am, you need to go home and pray. What? Oh my goodness! They're still not telling me what to do. Jeez Louise. All right. But I calmed down a little bit because he looked sane and okay, and I thought, if this kid can be sane and okay, maybe mine can too one of these days. So the roller coaster continued. I still didn't have a sponsor. Every now and again, I'd ask some learned-looking wise woman, would you mind being my sponsor? And of course, Al-Anons have got pretty good boundaries, and they'll say, well, no, I'm kind of busy. But you know what? Keep coming back. I can be on your support group, but I'm not available. And it's like, when am I ever going to need a sponsor, for goodness sake? I want to give you a couple of examples of how insane I was. One time my son called and he said, Mom, I've been arrested. Can you come down? They're going to impound my car. And I'm thinking, money. We don't want to spend $150 getting his car out of the impound. So sure enough, put on your Batman cape, woman, and drive. There he is, poor thing, in the back of a police car, looking very not happy. And I the scene. I'm good at assessing scenes. And it happened to be my birthday. We were supposed to be going out for dinner that night. Anyway, so I assessed the scene and I saw this very nice cop came over and I said, please don't arrest him. It's my birthday today, officer. We were going to go out for dinner. And the officer was, well, I'm very sorry about that, ma'am. So, of course, I had to do an Oscar award-winning little performance then and throw myself on the, we call it a bonnet, you guys call it a hood of his car, and wail. And I wailed, and the poor man, you know, I don't know whether he thought he should arrest me or what he should do. He said, ma'am, please stop crying. I hate to see a woman cry. So I thought, oh, good. Success. Hey, remember, we're manipulative, too. It's a family thing. So anyway, he was very nice. And he said, well, why don't you come down to the station? I won't take him downtown, and we'll talk to the sergeant, and we'll see what we can do. And sure enough, they let him out. What do you think that did for the rescuer? Ah! Your cape is working, woman. So we went for dinner. It was a pretty miserable dinner, actually, because we were mad with him, and I wasn't really sure that I'd done the right thing, actually, to be totally truthful. So that was an example of my little bit of insanity. Another time I can remember, I couldn't get a hold of my son, and he was over at a friend's place who was a very negative person in his life. And I found out where it was, and I went over there and started banging on the door, and they wouldn't open the door. So what does an Oscar award-winning person do? She makes a lot of noise and wails and cries outside the door until the friends get nervous, the police will be called, and shoves her son out the door. It worked. A very angry, irate young man came out the door, and I threw him in the car, and off we went again. So you can see I had some very seriously insane behaviors, and I really did need some rescuing. I continued going to school. I continued working towards getting an LCDC, and I eventually got a job at a women's treatment center. Remember, my original calling was to help women before they got to the point of losing their children or their lives. I've been there for the last 12 years as a counselor, and I have enjoyed the challenges, the rewards, the camaraderie with the amazing people that I work with, the spiritual content of the program, the everything about it. It's been hard work, but extremely rewarding. I don't know when I'll ever stop being there, actually. I think they'll have to carry me out one day on a stretcher. So I did that. I thought, too, that by becoming so knowledgeable about the disease of addiction, alcoholism, that I would be able to fix them, that I would have the information and the know-how to be able to fix him, counsel him, tell him. But you know that doesn't work. You can't counsel your own child. You're not supposed to. And they don't want to hear all that damn information that you've got. How helpful is it to have your mother leaving little pamphlets laying around in special places, right, where his keys are and where his cigarette packet is, and my step book open at step one powerlessness. And, oh, my God, I must have driven the poor guy totally nuts. It was while I was working there that I met my most amazing friend and support, and Courtney, who introduced me to my amazing sponsor. One day we were sitting there at lunch, and she reminded me, actually, this morning, and a client came up and said, Miss Maggie, rah, 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 you know, and Courtney said, excuse me, Miss Maggie's having lunch. You need to see her in about 20 minutes. I went, boing, you mean I can do that too? So she said, you know what? You really need a sponsor. You're really still quite sick. Oh, dear. All right. So I met my amazing sponsor, Kathy, and this was probably 8 or 9 years ago, and we started working in earnest on the steps, and I really got stuck into it and did my step one, the powerlessness that I had, that being that rescuer, the controller, the fixer person, the codependent was not working for me, and it was not helping the family, and certainly wasn't helping my son. And I might add, I have a very angry daughter in the background who, like me, took off. The chaos was too much for her, and she went back to New Zealand to live, which is sad because she's so far away. But guess what? She's happy over there. She never did go to an Al-Anon program, and I wish she would because she's still a very angry person. But my story. I worked on my steps, and it has been life-changing. One thing that my sponsor told me, that I told my sponsee, which I believe her sponsor told her, was look up the back of the ODAT and read everything in there on detachment. And so I would follow direction. I would read everything on detachment, and little by little my brain started to detach with love, which is what was the way back to sanity for me. She also showed me how to look for God in other people. She would say, look, I see the God in you. Look for the God in others. And I realized that I've always actually kind of done that when I was looking for friendship or whatever. I would look for someone that had that compassion, that I liked being around people that were loving. And how wonderful to be around here, people who are loving with good boundaries. One of my amends was included self-care and focusing on myself and the things that I need to do for me. And that was a powerful amends that I made to my son when I did my ninth step. And I really, really work on that. And when things are not going well, I double my efforts. I eat even more healthy. In the old days, I would have eaten 6 donuts to try and get over it. But now I try to really do what is right for me and go for that war and talk to my sponsor and pray and read my ODAT and read the big book too, by the way. So 2 years ago this month, August 2015, I got the call that nobody wants to get. Maggie, this, it was his roommate calling. I don't know how to tell you this, but the ambulance has just taken him to the ER. I'll meet you at Northeast Baptist. So we went feeling sick to our stomachs, and got there and discovered that he had been unconscious for about 18 hours, and he was in very grave condition, and the doctors told us that he probably was not going to make it, and that if he did, he was probably going to have a damaged brain or physical disabilities and possibly kidney damage and be on dialysis for the rest of his life. So he was on life support for 3 weeks. And every organ was impacted. His lungs had failed because he had asphyxiated on top of drinking in whatever else he'd taken. And he now had pneumonia, which turned into sepsis. He was gravely ill. My daughter flew in from New Zealand because we thought we'd be planning a funeral. And throughout that trial, there was nothing else to do but lean on God every minute of it, every day. To lean on my sponsor and friends that understood, the prayer group that prayed for us here and across the country. How did I continue to go to work here and there? Because I couldn't sit by his bed all day, every day, waiting. I had to get some balance, and so I would go to work for half a day, and I have an amazing boss and an amazing organization who supported me and understood. And so I was able to come and go, and I always made sure, of course, the controller and me, that I was there for shift change, damn it. And I was there when the doctors did their rounds because they weren't going to give the right instructions. I had to be there. Did you know this happened? Did you know that happened? And finally it got to a point. He was in a drug-induced coma because he couldn't cope with all the machinery and stuff, and they wanted to, after about 3 weeks, see that if he could breathe on his own, so they wanted to remove. So they started to bring him out of that state. And a couple of days they tried, and it wasn't going to happen. And they put a PICC line in, assuming that he was going to be on dialysis permanently. And so this was the touch-and-go moment. And my daughter had said to me, "Mom, are you sure he even wants to live? Do you know whether he was intentionally doing this?" And I said, "I don't know. I don't want to believe that. They finally managed to get this incubator or whatever they call out of his mouth, and he took his first breath, and the first words out of his mouth were, "I don't want to die." And when we heard that, it was like, thank God. You know, this is not going to be the battle that we thought. Because, you know, if someone really doesn't want to be here and they come around, it can be very difficult. He said some amazing things as he was coming out from under all of that. And it was a long road, but he was very determined, and he did his physiotherapy and everything that was expected. And I am so grateful to tell you today that he made a full recovery 2 years ago. Yes. You know, the doctor said that was a miracle. I believe in miracles, and that was a miracle. And that's why I am here today, because when something like that happens, you have to share it. I don't know your stories and what's going on in your personal lives, but you have to know that there is hope and that miracles occur and that prayer works. If you follow your heart and you follow God and you trust your program and you trust, just trust God, miracles do happen. Yes. They do. So I would like to say that that would be enough to frighten anyone straight, not using, drinking, or doing anything ever again. Well, unfortunately, we know the power of this disease, and it doesn't always work that way. And I'm not going to tell his story and go into a lot of detail, other than to say that the last year or so, a couple of years, has been a roller coaster again. But I have stayed close to my program throughout it all. And about 9 months ago, 8 months ago, back in treatment at another family program, we did our process and went through the pain, and it was an amazing program, a very amazing program, and it strengthened me and it gave me hope. And I am able to say, I don't think that my son gave me permission to say that he has 9 months clean and sober today, or this month. So, by the grace of God, no other way. I will say that, you know, throughout it all, it's easy when things are easy. Easy, it's never easy. But when someone is doing well for 8 or 9 months, it could be an excuse not to go into this little room anymore. Oh, he's all okay now, nothing to worry about. See, miracle, and he's a miracle, and woohoo, we're home free. No, it doesn't work that way. I've actually been going even more to meetings here during this time, because that horrible feeling of a shoe falling off is always there in the background. You know, that's the untreated side of Al-Anon and me, that fear, that family history of what's happened, the tragedies in the past. I went back and got some counseling in addition to attending my meetings, and I'm, again, ninth step amends, practicing self-care in every way, which way I can. It's been a journey, is all I can say, and I have no idea what the future holds. I work very hard on staying in the here and now and trusting God. And it works. That's what works. Now, I didn't get a sponsee for a long time because of my job, because I'm a bit selfish in some respects, because I also a bit insecure, not sure if I'd be that good of a sponsor. I'm a pretty good counselor, but was I going to be a good sponsor? Anyway, I prayed on it, and I talked to my sponsor about it, and I said, "God, if you want me to be a sponsor, let me know. So I go to a meeting, and sure enough, this precious person is sitting in there, and she has her story, and she said, I'm looking for a sponsor. So I wait at the end of the meeting, and I think someone else will do it. Nobody steps up, so all right, I get the message, God. So I go and step up, and I talk to her, and I say, let's meet, let's talk, let's see if we're a good fit. And I felt so proud. Again, I've got to really watch that rescuer, codependent, controlling fixer person in me, because I get a lot of pleasure out of feeling like I'm going to fix this girl. But I'm not going to fix her. I'm just going to tell her bits of my story and what worked for me. I wanted to highlight the parallel process that I've discovered in recovery for not only the alcoholic, but the family member. And I am so thrilled. I love this title, We Have Found Much of Heaven. And I'm not sure if that has been read out to you, but I want to read this part, and I want to share how it is Al-Anon as well as AA. It says, there is a solution. Almost none of us liked the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings, in my case, control, fear, pride, ego, which the process requires for its successful consummation. But we saw that it really worked in others. We came to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When therefore we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us to pick up the simple kit of the spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence, which we could not have dreamed. If someone had told me this 2 years ago, 4 years ago, that I could feel this amount of joy and that these tears would be tears of joy, gratitude, I couldn't have imagined it. The great fact is just this and nothing less. We've had a deep and effective spiritual experience which have revolutionized our whole attitude towards life, towards our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty, nothing but certainty, that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He's commenced to accomplish those things for us that we could never do by ourselves. If you are as seriously alcoholic, and I can slip in the words codependent, enabling, and controlling, as we were, we believe there is no middle of the road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible, and if we'd passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid, we had but two alternatives. One was to go to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could, and the other to accept spiritual help. Since I can't control it or cure it, and I now know I didn't cause it, my only recourse was to accept spiritual help. With every fiber of my being, I prayed for God's guidance, courage, and strength to see me through whatever lay ahead during those terrible times 2 years ago and every day since, no matter what. And I believe with all my heart that He will stay the course. My name is Maggie. I'm a grateful Al-Anon. Thank you for listening.